HUD Secretary Ben Carson visited Cairo in southern Illinois yesterday, where hundreds of residents in public housing are being forced to leave. The secretary acknowledged the scope of the big problem there.
There is a big problem.
What Secretary Carson had to say and how that message was received in Cairo. Plus, after 18 years serving the Metro East region of Illinois, pediatrician Kristen Stahl is crafting an exit strategy that may eventually close her practice.
I cannot keep seeing a large proportion of Medicaid patients and expect to send my children to college.
2 years of unpaid bills during the state's budget impasse have driven many providers into debt. What does all this mean for Medicaid patients in Illinois? And bedbugs are enough of a problem in central Illinois, one city created a bedbug coalition. We'll find out more about that coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Illinois may have a budget now, but it'll likely be months, even years in some cases, before the state can pay the nearly $15 billion in bills that piled up over the past 2 years. A good portion of that money is owed to doctors, other providers who serve some of the state's most vulnerable patients, patients on Medicaid. A new story from Side Effects Public Media highlights how doctors across the state are being pushed to the brink in some cases, making some difficult decisions as they wait on this process to play out. That includes Dr. Kristen Stahl, a pediatrician based in Collinsville, Illinois, about 15 miles east of the St. Louis area there. Dr. Stahl, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
So I understand that about 60%, a little over half of your patients are insured through Medicaid. That's the federal state program that provides health insurance to people with lower incomes or disabilities. What have these past 2 years been like for you, for your practice there, given the budget impasse?
It's been a real challenge for our practice. We don't know when we're going to get paid. We've had problems meeting payroll, drawing on a line of credit in order to pay our employees. We used to have about 30 to 40% of our practice had Medicaid, mm-hmm. and that's increased significantly over the past 2-4 years.
So how long would you go at a time without getting paid?
We are contracted to be paid within 30 days, and we've gone as long as 6 months.
So then you're taking out, like you said, a line of credit just to make payroll and trying to
yes.
sort of make do as you can. Stepping back a little bit, you've been in that area, sort of the Metro East area there for almost 2 decades. What is that area like, and sort of the who are you primarily serving there?
I have a wide variety of practice. I'm near a steel mill, so we have a lot of blue-collar workers. We also are near Edwardsville, Illinois, where mm-hmm. the Southern Illinois University is.
State workers, too, potentially, and now they're also not being paid in a lot
that's
of the,
also
the
been
insurance
a problem.
Problems.
Yeah. We also border on East St. Louis. We're in Madison County, so we have a big racial mix to our practice. It's a wonderful place to practice because of the variety.
Mm-hmm. So you're a pediatrician there. Is there a shortage of pediatricians? How, in terms of available doctors, how does that look for the area?
It feels like that's a bit of a problem because fewer and fewer doctors in the area are able to take Medicaid.
Yeah.
We've also had clinics nearby that have had that have pediatricians employed, and quite a few of them have left as well. There's a health clinic in a nearby town, Granite City, that was down to a nurse practitioner who had a small bit of pediatric knowledge that was seeing the patients after two pediatricians left.
Oh, wow. And so this, I mean, we're talking about these issues have been exacerbated by the state budget impasse, by what's going on in Illinois now. But, I mean, are these challenges getting paid to see Medicaid patients in particular, is this a new thing or has this sort of been growing over the years?
It's been growing. The state of Illinois has a history of payments which come in sporadically. But you combine that with two things. One, the increasing numbers of the population that are using Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
As well as in health insurance that has very high deductibles. And frequently we don't get paid on those very promptly either. But it's gotten to the point it's very difficult to keep the business running.
And is it just getting paid or claims being rejected in some form? Or are there just additional hoops to?
Absolutely. We have 3 providers down here that contract with Medicaid. That would be Meridian, Molina, and Harmony. And even when we are paid, it's a habitual problem that codes that they've paid for years, codes that are accepted by Illinois Public Aid, their computers just happen not to to recognize the code anymore. There's a variety of
the problems that just sort of
problems
creep up
yeah.
in all this. So here we are now. You know, we talked about some of the difficult choices that many doctors are having to make around the state right now. I mean, you're opening a new practice across the border in St. Louis. Are you hoping that will sort of
have family to help support me? But it's time to move to a new state and where I know I can get paid better, and I will take less Medicaid. And this is the only way I can see out.
So I can even hear in your voice that this is a decision that you talked about, sort of serving the area there where you're at. You've got a long history with a lot of the patients there, that this is not an easy decision for you. Why St. Louis? Why Missouri? What's drawing doctors like you across the border?
Move to areas that have less Medicaid. It's really the percentage of how much Medicaid you keep in your practice. That's how well you get paid, how well your office does, how comfortable you can be adding on doctors.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of Medicaid, and then with a state that doesn't pay the Medicaid, very difficult to make ends meet.
It just adds up. So what's next then for Heartland Pediatrics there in the Metro East area? Are you going to keep that open? Is that going to have to close eventually?
I think we'll just have to see. I think I need an escape plan. I think I can't keep trying to function in the same capacity here when it's not working in these 20 years. I have another 20 years left, and I would like to try something different.
Yeah.
So I can't really answer that. I'm going to try to cover both for a while, but I don't know what will happen.
Yeah, and again, sort of that impossible decision.
My goal is to get a new office up and running. That's a little bit more lucrative than what we're doing here,
unfortunately, and it's, you know, we'll talk more about this here in a minute, but you know, you're not the only one having to make some of these decisions and choices, you know, with the state budget the way it's been and payments being so slow and other things going on. But thank you very much for sharing your story. We'll continue this conversation here, but I appreciate it, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Kristen Stahl, pediatrician based in Collinsville, Illinois, the owner of Heartland Pediatrics there, facing obviously some difficult choices. Joining me now in studio, one of our producers here on the 21st, Christine Herman. She's been reporting on this issue for Side Effects Public Media. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
So there has been some movement, I guess, from the state in recent weeks to get some Medicaid providers paid. Where are we on that?
Right. So in early July, the state passed a budget, as you mentioned. But actually, the week prior to that, at the end of June, there was a federal court order that basically there's a federal judge who said required the state needs to start prioritizing payments
to Medicaid.
Yeah. So at the end of July, actually, there was a big check that was written by the Illinois Comptroller, Susana Mendoza, paying down about 1/5 of the debt owed to Medicaid providers. So it had been more than $3 billion. So she wrote a check for $740 million to 11 different managed care organizations. That's what Dr. Kristen Stahl mentioned there, these privatized groups.
To the managed care organizations.
Right.
So
these are the middlemen that serve between the state and the providers. So the state pays them, and then they pay the providers for services that are rendered to the patients, Medicaid patients who they manage. But from what I've been hearing from other doctors who I've spoken to, and as you just heard from Dr. Stahl, that money isn't quite trickling down to them. Not quite yet.
So, you know, I know you spoke, we obviously talked with Dr. Kristen Stahl, and I appreciate her sharing her story and essentially deciding that, you know, she can't work for free anymore, which is essentially what she had sort of laid out there, what the situation was for the last 2 years. There are other pediatricians that you've talked to, doctors across the state, but you talked with three other pediatricians in the Metro East area. What were you hearing from them?
A lot of similar situations to what Dr. Stahl is experiencing, some even worse than what she described, taking out lines of credit from the bank, even maxing out those lines, having to take out personal loans, or just relying on savings. They are not paying themselves for months just so that they can continue to pay their staff, pay their rent, keep
their
doors
open. So not taking a salary at all, just to
keep
investing in the business.
Some of them for even up to 4 months now. Oh. So, you know, they talk about challenges and frustrations working with these managed care organizations, as Dr. Stahl had mentioned, you know, and reimbursement rates for Medicaid are already low. Actually, Illinois ranks 43rd in the nation for Medicaid spending per enrollee. That's according to the Kaiser Family Foundation 2014 data. But really, just a lot of frustrations. I mean, some have even stopped vaccinating children if they're covered by Medicaid because the state recently started requiring that pediatricians pay up front for those vaccines. They can cost up to $200 a shot, and that can add up. So,
you have to buy them in advance.
Mm-hmm. And then wait for the state to pay
that. So they're sending them to public health
departments or just somewhere else. And who knows then if they're going to get those vaccines or not. So it's also creating issues with access to care. So one of the doctors I spoke with, his name is Dr. David Norman. He's in Belleville and he specializes in child abuse pediatrics. So he sees some of the state's highest risk patients, including foster kids that have a history of trauma and abuse. And he's owed more than $300,000 right now. And here's what he had to say.
If we didn't pay the state, we would be in jail. It's absolutely unconscionable and unrealistic that they can expect people that they owe money to can survive without payments. The next step for me to survive if they don't start paying is I'm going to have to start selling assets.
And he's even said that he's looked into selling his practice like to a bigger hospital system, but that they're not interested because they have all this debt and they're not sure when they're going to get paid. But he says that, you know, he really does not want to have to close his doors.
I don't want to turn these highest risk patients away because you feel like these are the kids that you really can intervene and make a difference. And they're making it harder and harder and harder to do it.
Yeah, we heard a similar thing from Dr. Stahl a few minutes ago. If you have a relationship with the patients, you know that there's a community there that you are a part of and play a big role in. And to have to make some of these decisions, again, you can hear it there in Dr. Norman's voice, to make these decisions based on not getting paid is frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
You know, one of the people you talked to in this story is Jenny Pinkwater. She leads the state's chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Let's bring her into the conversation here, too, to take a little bit bigger picture around the state. Jenny, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm doing okay. Thank you for the time today. Now, you've heard a couple of stories or a couple of examples from doctors. You know, what have you been hearing from providers throughout the state around this issue of getting paid for Medicaid?
Unfortunately, that's what we hear from most providers in the state. We have about 2,200 members in our state, and you know, we've heard from quite a few of them, especially those that are small independent practices that are really just struggling to keep their doors open, to continue to see the population that they have seen for years, you know, in some cases generations. They're just, with this delayed payment coming from the state, they just haven't been able to pay themselves to keep their doors open. You've heard many of the stories from Dr. Stahl as well as Dr. Norman, and unfortunately that's what we're hearing throughout the whole state. Southern Illinois and Central Illinois tend to be a little bit more stressed because of the lack of payment from state employees as well. So we see those areas under even that additional stress waiting for payments from the treatment for children of state employees, too.
And rural areas, I mean, they tend to have, there's already fewer providers in some cases. The margins can be much slimmer in some rural areas. Is that also playing out in some cases?
Yes, for sure. You know, and we tend to see, you know, in the metropolitan areas, they tend to be more larger consolidated practices that might have backing of hospital systems or hospital associations. So they're able to weather the storm a little bit more than the small independent providers, which we see, you know, in those more rural communities that are more embedded within those communities as well. So, you know, as Dr. Stahl was saying, you know, she has a long history of seeing those patients and understanding those families and the unique needs within that community. And because as an independent provider, she might be the only person in that area that's seeing those children. And, you know, as an independent group, it's just much harder to keep your doors open if you don't have that backing of a larger healthcare system.
And is that the primary issue? You mentioned the sort of independent, the private practice physicians. They're running a business as well as running a practice. Is that primarily the folks who are getting hit hardest by this? Is this also affecting some of the larger groups?
Well, the larger groups are for sure being affected. They're owed, certainly, in some cases, millions of dollars from the state. If you look at the larger, especially the children's health hospitals, who are predominantly Medicaid. So if you look at a Springfield hospital, you know, they're owed probably millions of dollars just related to back Medicaid payments. And so they're certainly stressed in their ability to continue to provide care. They do. It's their mission. And they're able to kind of draw on different resources for that. With the smaller groups or the smaller independent practices, they just, you know, they don't have that same type of backing, so they're additionally stressed and have to, you know, operate as a small business would. I think we've also seen that in the conversations related to the community providers in general, related to social services, that they've had to make drastic cuts or to not pay themselves or take out lines of credit, and that is unfortunately not unusual no matter where you go in the state.
And does that affect recruiting, I guess? Does that affect people's decisions and choices? We heard Dr. Stahl talking about leaving the state of Illinois. Is it difficult to get doctors to come to Illinois?
We certainly have many concerns about that. We have 11 pediatric residency programs in the states. We do a really good job of training doctors and pediatricians in Illinois. And, you know, they're certainly looking at their bottom line, too, as they choose to open practices or take fellowships in either different parts of the state or different parts of the country, and whether or not they choose to stay in Illinois. It's certainly a matter of choice for them, in some cases economic choices. They certainly are graduating with debt and do have to make those decisions that work for them as well as trying to further their career. So although we don't have specific data related to that, it will continue to be a consideration and a concern that we'll look at as we move forward.
That's Jenny Pinkwater, Executive Director of the Illinois Chapter of American Academy of Pediatrics. Also with us here in studio, Christine Herman, producer of the 21st Show, reporter with Illinois Public Media and Side Effects Public Media. She reported this story, taking a look at how the lack and the delay of Medicaid payments is really affecting doctors across Illinois and some of the tough choices they're having to make. Much more on this coming up in a moment. You're listening to the 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo here today. We're talking about doctors in Illinois and the delay in getting paid, particularly around patients who are covered by Medicaid, and some of the difficult choices and decisions that's forcing some doctors to make. Earlier, we heard from Dr. Kristen Stahl in the Metro East area, opening a practice in Missouri, just finally having to decide to leave Illinois to keep her business going. Talking with Jenny Pinkwater, Executive Director of Illinois Chapter of American Academy of Pediatrics, also Christine Herman, producer of the 21st Show, and a reporter with Side Effects Public Media. She reported this whole story out for Side Effects. And Christine, coming back to you, I mean, you mentioned earlier these managed care organizations that are working with the providers, that the state has paid them at least some of the money that they're owed from this big backlog over the state budget crisis. But you reached out to three of those organizations, working with providers in the Metro East area, asking about prioritizing payments, providers, things like that. What did they tell you?
So they declined interviews, but then they didn't quite answer my question. I'd asked, like you said, how will they prioritize payments to providers going forward? Meridian Health Plan, which you heard Dr. Stahl mention, didn't respond to multiple requests for comments. And two others, Molina and Harmony, they both just sent me an email statement saying that they have continued to pay all provider claims throughout the budget crisis, despite lack of payments from the state. But these claims are contested by the doctors who I've interviewed for this story, who have said, no, there have been significant delays and reductions in the amount that they're getting from these managed care organizations for services that they've already provided to Medicaid patients.
So, Jenny, I mean, how long do you think or expect until Illinois doctors get on more stable footing from all of this?
Well, that's the one thing we're looking into right now. As Christina mentioned, that with the recent court ruling that passed that was issued right before the state budget, we do know that Medicaid payments to Medicaid are prioritized both through that court order as well as The Comptroller's Office has also said that they're making an effort to prioritize Medicaid payment. Part of that is because for every dollar that the state spends, they get 50 cents back from the federal government on that. It's about a 51% match from the federal government related to Medicaid spending, so it makes sense for them to prioritize Medicaid payment. Unfortunately, as we've run into many times within payments in Illinois, that you can only make payments if you have cash. And so at this point, there's a lot of look at the governor's office in terms of how they're going to move forward in issuing bonds to be able to have enough cash on hand to start making more robust payments. We have heard from a few providers that despite the fact that we know that the comptroller's office has released payments, those have not yet trickled down to providers, and we're in the midst of looking into that further to determine if it's kind of a check in the mail type situation, or if it's if they have chosen to prioritize different payments over kind of primary care. So we're in the midst of trying to unravel that a little bit more.
Yeah, and investigate some of that. You know, we've been talking about the doctors. I mean, that's sort of the initial thing that we can see right now. But the flip side then, obviously, is the patients and the care and things like that. I mean, what concerned you about, you know, private practice providers who serve areas with high concentrations of Medicaid, especially when they're pushed to the brink this way?
I mean, these are already very stressed populations for a variety of different reasons. You also have to understand that they're also facing the lack of payment of community resources within those areas, too, so those other social service agencies.
The state budget has also stressed all of those things.
Right, exactly. So, you know, they might not have the other support that they've had in the past, too. So we're certainly, this is yet another kind of symptom of what we see is as these providers start to close, that it's really going to hurt families and patients. We're especially concerned related to payments related to immunizations and school visits as we move into school health season. You know, this is the time of year when people are taking their kids to the doctor to get ready for school and get those school physicals completed. And if providers start closing and they're not able to give immunizations, we're concerned about what this is going to look like for the ability for children to continue school.
Well, even to get in. I mean, Christine, do you see this play out if providers here are struggling and may have to close their doors? You mentioned access to care earlier. Are you seeing that as an issue right now as the doctors you talked to?
Some of the providers that I had talked to said that at some point throughout the budget impasse, they had either limited the number of Medicaid patients they would see or they'd turn away any new Medicaid patients for a period of time. And the federal court documents that I obtained from one of the lead attorneys in that federal court case that Jenny mentioned, you know, they compiled all this evidence basically to make a case to the federal judge that when the state doesn't pay these managed care organizations, they don't pay the providers, and the providers start turning Medicaid patients away.
Right.
And then it creates a real issue of access to care. So it's the sort of thing where these patients, they have insurance, but they may not actually be able to see a doctor. And if payments don't start flowing, you know, to help these practices get back on more stable footing, this can continue to be an ongoing issue.
And I mean, it does, Jenny, coming back to you here as we wrap up, I mean, it seems like, you know, we're hearing more about that kind of problem. If people have insurance, they're covered by Medicaid, but still they can't see a doctor. The doctor won't accept them even to get basic care. I mean, obviously the state paying its bills is going to be a big step in getting some of these places on more financial sound footing. But, you know, are there other sort of solutions that need to be looked at or are being looked at to sort of deal with that access to care issue that Christine talked about?
I mean, what we've seen be successful in other states is really competitive payments for Medicaid providers. So I think Christine mentioned earlier that we have a very low rate of Medicaid payment in general in Medicaid, and then you layer on top of that additional administrative burdens, new administrative burdens related to working with managed care organizations. They'll be working with new managed care organizations as the state announces new contracts that will start on January 1st, and these are certainly all administrative barriers to participation in Medicaid. So in addition to general increasing of rates to being more competitive with what surrounding states pay in relation to their clientele, also this reduction of administrative barriers. So if you're a physician and you need to prescribe medication for one of your Medicaid patients, reducing the amount of time it takes to get pre-authorization for that medication, for example. So that's additional kind of unseen costs that practice must bear. You have to devote staff time to billing and payment and pre-authorizations and all of those types of things. So the more you can reduce those costs and barriers help too.
Do you have any advice, I guess, for someone, if I'm on Medicaid right now and I am in sort of a rural area of Illinois, I'm seeing this play out, what should people know?
We really encourage patients as well as our members to be advocates for themselves. So working with your managed care organization, if you're looking for a referral as a patient or a specialty referral, that's really your kind of first line of defense. We also really encourage providers, our members, and others to reach out to their elected officials. This is a really complicated situation, and so sometimes it takes a lot of conversations with elected officials to really understand how they can help address these situations. So those are the two avenues that we always encourage folks to do.
Which both center on sort of advocating for yourself, mm-hmm. which is not always easy to do. Jenny Pinkwater, Executive Director, Illinois Chapter of American Academy of Pediatrics. Christine Herman, producer of the 21st Report of the Side Effects Public Media, who originally reported out this story. Thank you both. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. You know, it's not every day that the head of the Federal Housing Agency comes to town. Secretary Ben Carson was in Cairo, southern Illinois, yesterday. His agency faces some tough questions about its handling of a decades-long crisis in two large public housing complexes there. Hundreds of residents in those buildings, Elmwood and McBride, were told in April that they would have to move after decades of neglect and alleged mismanagement. The buildings no longer considered safe to live in. The stakes here are high, possibly the future of the community itself. We're going to talk about what Secretary Carson had to say, how that message was received by residents in Cairo. Molly Parker is a reporter with the Southern Illinoisan. She's been covering this issue for years now. Heard Secretary Carson's presentation yesterday, also interviewed him before the public event and spoke with us yesterday before all this went on. Molly, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Scott. Thank you very much for having us on.
Yeah, it's been a busy couple of days for you. Speaking at the high school yesterday, I know Carson said that Cairo was in serious trouble, but he said, quote, by the grace of God, it's possible to save this place. He was asked to apologize for his recent comment calling Cairo a dying town. He did apologize, and he went on to kind of address some of the other concerns. What was his overall message, I guess, to residents?
You know, he came in and he said he was going to have an open mind when he was down here. A lot of the public officials I've talked to said he did come in with an open mind. He toured the Elmwood and McBride complexes. He was driven around by the mayor to see various parts of the city. He said he was learned a lot about the economic opportunities here that a lot of people have been banging on the door about, you know, now for decades about the potential for an inland river port or something to do with commerce and trade,
Yeah, the history and geography point to all of that. Yeah, some possibilities.
Yeah, exactly. Down here at the confluence of two major rivers, you know, a lot of people say, well, why didn't we have this before? Of course, there's a lot of complicated reasons why a lot of things haven't happened in Cairo before. But there was optimism that was offered. There was not any money, though, that was offered along with that optimism at this point.
At this point. Okay. And we will talk with the mayor here in just a minute. But you know, you sat down, as I mentioned, with Secretary Carson for an interview before that public event and some of his private tours and things. He talked about, among other things, the challenges facing residents there in Elmwood and McBride. And let's take a listen here. He talked about the limited options available at this point.
You know, I recognize the emotional attachment people have to the places where they live. I think they understand that these units are not, you know, a place that we can just say, okay, go ahead and live there after discovering what's going on there. But we continue to look for all viable options for those who want to stay. But we don't have the ability to just create housing. It doesn't work that way.
Audio there from your interview at the Southern Illinois and with Secretary Ben Carson yesterday. Hearing that, I mean, did he point to any options other than people just having to leave?
He talked about they are making some efforts to rehab an old facility that closed a couple years ago that used to house people with mental disabilities. When that nonprofit closed, those individuals left a building vacant. It's about 10 units in Cairo. They're primarily small, like one- or two-bedroom units that would be mostly housing seniors or single people. Mm. A lot of the Elmwood and McBride, those are considered family developments. So most of the individuals out there have children, and many of them have large families. So that's not really a viable option for them. They are also talking about rehabbing some units in Thebes. And there's some uncertainty there about the financing of that. But they are talking about trying to get about 15 or so units over there. Of course, that's not Cairo. I think they're aware of that, but that's a different school system, and it's not within the city of Cairo. And while it is within the county, there are a lot of differences to people that are attached to Cairo. So I don't know how eagerly people will move to Thebes, but that's what they're talking about so far. They are not talking about, what, from what I can gather, any major new developments coming out of the ground right now. What he said about that is that we need that private sector investment, and that he said, you know, if the mayor's got people he can get on the line, we're willing to work with them, we're willing to talk to them, and perhaps if we can highlight the economic opportunity here, that perhaps the developer would be willing to, I gather, to take a risk, is what he's saying, on the hope or promise or possibility that down the road you have an inland port, you change the economic dynamics of Alexander County and have more people of middle income with more wealth moving back into the county to sort of balance out the economic realities there. But that's sort of a long shot deal. And again, that's when I say he offered a lot of hope and optimism, but no concrete answers at this stage.
You talk about some of the reaction that went on at the Southern. You guys posted a video of the event. NPR stations this morning aired a story with some voices from Cairo. We compiled some of that audio. Let's take a listen here to just what some of the residents who were in the audience yesterday had to say.
When you were doing your operations, just like they called you and said, Dr. Carson, come. This heart needs to be repumped. You came here today. Our heart needs to be repumped.
Yeah.
You're not going to get anything done if a person comes to a meeting with a closed mind. But if you come objectively, which I believe that he did, and he listened, and he asked questions.
I think it's a political thing, the reason why he's coming down here, because you already sent the letter saying, it's unfortunate, but we can't help you. This is my home. Before they tore down our hospital, I was born in that hospital.
The voices there of Stephen Tarver, Philip Matthews, and Melvin Duncan. Thanks to the Southern Illinoisan and to NPR for that tape. All residents of Cairo were in the audience during Secretary Ben Carson's visit yesterday. I want to talk a little bit more about reaction and things like that, but we've only got a couple minutes left in this segment before we have to take a break. And joining us now on the line from Cairo is Mayor Tyrone Coleman. Mayor, welcome to the show. Thanks for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I'm curious, I mean, from your perspective, you know, you spent time with the mayor yesterday, you went on tour, you heard him speak there in the gymnasium in the school. Do you think anything's changed for Cairo?
Do I think anything has changed for Cairo? No. There was nothing to bring about a change. There was a visitation by Secretary of HUD, which should have been done prior to, I think, anyway, a decision being made to move forward in what they're currently doing.
Yeah, that April decision that those 400
right.
folks have to leave.
Right. Now, I do think that he saw a difference from what he had been told about this community when he actually came face to face with the physical site as well as the people.
Mm-hmm.
He had an opportunity to talk to quite a few people, actually.
And to understand the community, the history there, the legacy,
right.
the vibrancy that town brings.
Exactly. And as we rode around the city and all of that, I watched his body language as well as just some of the comments that he made. Most people, when they come here, already have a perception of Cairo from what they've heard, what they've gathered from the foolishness on the internet and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Even from the people who live here, talk against themselves, actually. And so, when people come here and they stay here over a period of time, when they normally leave with a different perception of Cairo. Cairo has fallen upon hard times for a period of time, and that's because our elected officials at the state and federal level had neglected this area.
For a long time.
Tyrone Coleman, I just need to
jump in here real quick. We're coming up on a break, but let's continue. I mean, I'll let you hear more about sort of what you observed from Secretary Carson yesterday, more about that history and sort of what led to this, and more about what's coming next and what you heard from the Secretary next going forward. Also on the line, Molly Parker, reporter of the Southern Illinoisan. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st.
the 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. After his federal housing agency told nearly one in six residents of Cairo, Illinois, that have to move, Secretary Ben Carson was in that Southern Illinois community yesterday, talked about the future of the two public housing complexes that are set to close, the residents of those buildings, and the future of the town itself. We're talking about what he had to say, how his message played out to those in Cairo. On the line with us, as we were speaking just before the break, Mayor Tyrone Coleman. Also on the line, Molly Parker, reporter with the Southern Illinois, has been following this story for a long, long time, broke some of the initial details about alleged mismanagement in some of the housing agencies down there, both of them here on the 21st with us. Mayor, I'm sorry, coming up on the break, the clock here can be kind of brutal, but you were sort of describing spending time yesterday with the secretary, some of the what you saw in his reactions as he met people, as he came to understand the history, the legacy, you know, what Cairo is all about and what the community is all about. Right. And I think when I interrupted you, you were talking about kind of that state officials, in many cases, kind of let Cairo get to where it is today.
I'm looking at it from the perspective of our local elected officials over the years, as well as our state and federal officials over the years have either neglected the community or had a part in the demise of the community locally.
And how did that play out? I mean, what do you see when you talk?
What I mean by that is, it's like no one has ever had the community at heart, or the people of the community at heart. It's been family or close associates that's prospered over the years, but the masses of the people who live here have suffered behind all of that, from all the lucrative contracts that were bestowed upon the housing, and as well that moved over into the city. It's just been a complete. All of this is man-made. None of this is it came out of a natural, so to say.
A man-made disaster, yeah.
It's a man-made disaster, and it's going to take a different mindset of people to move forward. And there is a nucleus of people who have started to come together to do whatever can be done to help move this city forward. Well, it's my belief, there's no doubt in my mind, that at some point this is going to be again another vibrant community. It's all of this has to manifest. It's kind of like saying those seeds that have previously been sown have surfaced, and now they're being plucked up and destroyed, and so life can come again.
So I kind of hear you describing this turning point. Then, you know, and Mayor, much of what Secretary Carson said yesterday focused on, you know, marketing, on recruiting private investment, on sort of rebuilding
exactly.
that economic base. You know, exactly. there's no money that was, at least from what I'm hearing, is a promise in terms of federal dollars or anything. But you know, what is the path forward? I mean, these seeds that you said are there now. How do you move forward?
We just have to market this community and the availability of opportunity being here. I mean, you got to remember, we said, among the two greatest rivers in these United States of America, the world, for that matter, and we haven't reaped the benefits of that. So, you know, there's work moving forward to remedy that. We're working on a port authority, trying to obtain a port authority here, and just getting people to come and take a look at what's here from the business perspective. We have our own regional airport. There's rail here. There's interstate here. I mean, we're right here in the midst of everything. It's just that people have, for whatever reason, chosen Carroll to put down. That's not the word I really want to use, but this is the only word that's coming forward right now.
Yeah, no, but I think I understand. You also talked.
We sit here and you would think that this is one horrible, terrible place to come to, and it's not. But I can tell you that the surrounding communities that are larger than us, they have more violence, they have more all those kinds of things. But for some reason, you only hear about Carroll when a situation occurs in Carroll. We have a lot of foolishness that takes place here. 90% of our police calls are domestic, people fighting.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get to the point of killing each other and all those kinds of things. But you literally have people getting shot and killed in other communities around us. But you basically, it's passed over. But you let a fight come up in Carroll, it makes the news.
You know, and you had talked earlier about that negativity, that those perceptions, that they've even sort of begun to, I don't know if infect is the right word, but to sort of pervade the mindsets locally, that people start to believe what they
exactly.
see and hear and read
exactly.
and things like that. You know, exactly. But I also hear you describing that there is a vibrant future out there. Now there is the attention of the federal government. The Secretary of
right.
HUD has come to town, you know,
right.
so... What? How do you change that? I mean, I guess you can't control the outside perceptions. You can't control the message that goes out there. But I suppose there is some sense of control locally about what, you know, who's there in the community and the efforts that are going on there. So where do you begin?
I think that two things have to take place. You have to affect the mindset of people, but they have to see something rather than just saying something's going to take place. People need to see something tangible, and that's what we have to make. If the first industry that comes here, you know, we've had a comprehensive plan developed. We've talked about businesses coming, but the business hadn't gotten here yet. Retail businesses, a few of them, but to make this community thrive again, it's going to take industry,
mm-hmm.
where salary base is enough for a person can go out and purchase a home. It's been about 50 years since a private home has been built in this community. So, there's a lot of factors as to why or when Carroll is going to be where I pitch it to be.
And if I can just jump in here.
We have to market it. We have to come up with a marketing for this community. We have to market it. Why? And tell the story why someone needs to come here and build, or come here and establish a business and then bring in families and all those kinds of things.
Yeah,
and that hasn't been done.
Okay.
Like I said, we had a comprehensive plan done, but now we have to market the place and tell of the advantages of coming to Carroll and living in Carroll.
And tell your own story there.
Yeah.
Molly Parker with the Southern Illinois in there, just come back to you for a minute here. I mean, one idea that you raised yesterday, you know, on this show was the hope that in the community there, that Secretary Carson's visit might draw more attention on a regional, the national level to some of the challenges facing rural communities. You know, obviously too early to know exactly for sure, but I mean, do you get a sense that yesterday opened that door for people?
I think that as a newspaper, and I think Mayor Coleman would probably agree, that we'll all be in our own respective roles continuing to bang that drum. Carroll has certainly a unique set of challenges, which Mayor Coleman just addressed some of them, that the long arm of corruption has consequences that kids, you know, kids that live there now or are growing up there now are paying for sins of the past, if you will. It's not so much the current climate as it is those who came before. But, you know, I think that's part of it. And Mayor Coleman and I have engaged in these conversations on a number of occasions that Carroll gets sort of the short end of the stick on the negativity sometimes. But many of the communities in what I would call, I mean, you could slice and dice it how you want, but I'm Southern Illinois, you could say from Mount Vernon South, or you could even then go a little deeper into what many people call southernmost Southern Illinois or the Southern Seven counties, which have a lot of characteristics that are similar in their makeup. A lot of those communities are struggling. You know, like you said, a lot of those problems are not just Carroll-specific problems. And so, you know, I asked the secretary, is this a region you can look at with all of these opportunities here and all that came out of this pretty, you know, we could probably all agree, pretty ugly presidential campaign, mm-hmm. Pretty divisive in our country. But one thing that Rural America said was, you know, we want to see something happen. We want to see policies that work here. And I don't think that that means that you have to say, you know, all our communities need to suddenly grow to be 50,000 or even 15,000. But people want to be able to make a living. They want their government to work for them. And that is local, state, and federal, and particularly in the case of Alexander, where in Illinois, which is perceived to be one of the most corrupt states in the nation, and then drill down to Alexander County, which has a reputation of dealing with some of the greatest amount of corruption at the government level over history, not currently, mm-hmm. over history in the state. And you go look there and see what's happened. You know, there has been investment there. It's just that in some cases those investments have been squandered. In some cases, like the state, you know, the state came down and built a prison. Governor Edgar came down into Alexander County. It wasn't Carroll. It was nearby Tams. But, I mean, you're talking about a, you know, 10-15-minute drive, and built a supermax prison, was going to save Alexander County. All of these promises, everybody cheering and, you know, this is going to be a turnaround. Well, 15 years later, we invest, you know, $500 million, and the prison just sits there. You know, so there has to be responsible policies, and we can't look to government to save our area in total. And I think you hear Mayor Coleman talking about those things, that aggressively pursuing private development and taking it upon ourselves to, you know, yes, we in this region can be victimized by corruption, but we also are responsible as voters, as citizens, as families, to stand up and, you know, and to take a stand when things are going wrong, because that's part of it. You know, you look at people who have caused the corruption, but you also have to look at, you know, the fact that these people keep getting voted into office. And that's not about just Carroll. That's our whole mm-hmm. state, right?
That's
so
well,
we have
we've
these
heard
problems
that, up and down
that we
the
have
state,
to
yeah.
get engaged in.
Yeah. Mayor, coming back, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, unfortunately, so I have to sort of wrap things up in a minute. But there is all this attention right now. It's focused primarily on the challenges, like you're saying. But you've referenced a lot of good and a lot of things that you see that can come down the road here. What, at this moment in time, what do you want people outside of Cairo to know about your community?
That we're no different than they are. Everybody here wants the same thing. As Americans, we think along the same terms, really: life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And we extend that to our elected officials to make those things possible. And they've fallen in that area. I'm not responsible for the citizens of this community, but I am responsible to and to provide a healthy, safe place for them to live. A workable infrastructure and all those kinds of things. Where here, even though people have gotten paid over the years, but the infrastructure hasn't been maintained. And you can take that nationwide. Our infrastructure all over these United States of America is almost like third class, third world
yeah.
infrastructure. Airports, everything, bridges, roads, everything is just ridiculous to be living in the greatest country on the face of the earth, and I do believe that. But yet we're in the midst of a mess from north to south, from east to west, and we just can't continue to do the same thing, expecting something different, something different is going to have to take place. And that's through our elected officials and how we elect officials. We can't just continue to put the same people in over and over again, and nothing is progressing. But yeah. For some reason, we do that.
That's slow-moving man-made disaster that you referenced earlier. Unfortunately, we are out of time here. That's the voice of Mayor Tyrone Coleman, Cairo, Illinois. Also on the line, Molly Parker, reporter with the Southern Illinois, and has been all over the story. Read their stuff from the weekend going back 2 years in Alexander Housing Authority and all that's gone on. And even before that, leading up to all of these conversations. Mayor, good luck to you. Thank you very much for talking with us. I hope we can talk again. And Molly, it was nice to talk with you again as well.
Thanks, Scott.
And the 21st is produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, Sean Newman, Megan Jones, our intern. Technical direction engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon, Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.